Right, good morning. I say to you, Alec, it's not negative and positive. A friend of mine recently told me something that I wished I'd learned 20 years ago, which is people see the world through two prisms. Most people see the world through the consensus prism. If they see consensus around an issue, that is what they tend to believe. And there's a fraction of people that see the world through a true and false prism. And the purpose of strategic analysis, negative and positive don't come into it at all. It's about being right and being correct and seeing through the true and false prism. And the stuff that came across as deeply negative 15 years ago was because it was correct, and it jarred with a society that was out of touch with reality and what was going to happen to it. And the stuff that's come through as positive, it happens to be very positive, is based on the same methodology. And that's what I'm going to try and do for you today about what to expect from this GNU. A few comments about the GNU, and then because you're at an investment conference, some of the flags that you need to watch on its downside to make informed decisions about it. The first comment to make about the GNU is that its structure is its strength. It's a government of national unity, and it is that. But inside that, it's a coalition between the ANC and the DA, and it can be both things. But beneath that, it's something else. It's a deal between the established and the aspirant middle classes. And that gives it its strength, because those two constituencies will be the great majorities of any South African election for the next generation, and the interests are aligned. And we know it's that because of the numbers. In this election, the ANC got 40% of its votes from township voters, the urban fringe, the aspirant middle class. It got 40% from traditional rural areas, and it got 20% from other things. And the ANC's shrewdest strategic thinkers understood that they couldn't double down on the rural base to survive politically, because the size of that electoral market is being eroded at the mortality and immigration rate to an extent that if the ANC just tries to hold that onto that market as its growth strategy, arguably by 2029, it's down another 10 percentage points, and it's nearer 30%. And to survive and remain relevant in a future South Africa, the ANC needs to capture the hopes and imagination of the aspirant middle class on the urban fringe. And this was understood and was a major reason why the populist deal wasn't made. The DA vote share, more than half of it came from the established multi-generational middle class, which is the DA market. And the ANC cannot capture that market again because it's too shell-shocked by the experiences of state capture and load shedding and potholes and the various other things that drive opinion there. And my advice to the DA has long been that it shouldn't try and grow its vote share significantly, because its vote share is determined by the size of that established multi-generational middle class. And its strategy instead should be to take that, whatever it is, into a deal with whoever commands the aspirant middle class. And if you do that, you will have substantial political majorities in any future generation, in any future election out into the next generation. So this deal isn't some sort of accidental thing that was stumbled upon. There are deep structural reasons why it works, and it's the only structural deal that could work to see South Africa survive as a successful unitary state. So we're very, very fortunate that we've come upon it. Second point to make is that the deal is very popular among South Africans, and it was popular even before it was struck. I chair one of the country's polling groups. In the run-up to the election, we saw that 60% plus of black voters were strongly supportive or supportive of the idea that the ANC strikes the deal with the DA. On the DA side, the same thing was true, and on the white voter camp, the same thing was true. So it's complete nonsense what you read in the mainstream media, that this was some great sacrifice on the part of both parties, despite the wishes of their constituents, made this deal that might not hold together because people are inherently opposed to it. So structurally it's sound, and it has significant public support, because public opinion in the country is much more centrist and sensible and moderate than the impression created in the mainstream media. Third point on the deal is that it both sides saw a strategic reason to do it. The ANC's strategic reason, the sort of motive reason, was that if they did not do this deal and they doubled down in practice on the rural populist base, they could be annihilated. And the sensible thinkers and the hotheads and the others didn't understand that, but the sensible people certainly understood that. And on the flip side of that, there were opposition strategists who said, you know, if it can be managed, engineered, that the ANC is forced into a deal with the EFF and MK, the consequences for them might be so severe that come 2029, you could build a much stronger, you could hammer them really hard in that election. And as a political strategy, that would have worked, I think. But the price the country would have paid would have been immense. And to the great credit of many of the people involved, and John Steenhuisen was central to this, that strategy was abandoned because of the price the country would have paid for it, even though it might have worked politically for the DA. On the DA side of things, the strategic understanding was in some places, in the top places, this: that the idea cast around that the ANC should be destroyed now, ground into the dust, sent to 2029 with the EFF and wrecked, was very dangerous. Because if the EFF, if the ANC vote share fell, let's say, from the current 40 into the 20s, it dropped 17 percentage points in this election, so that's not an exaggeration. And the DA base is the established middle class, which hasn't grown. The ANC-DA collective is sub 50%. And the reason to do this deal with the ANC now was that it could be done. It was a viable partner to work with. And if the ANC was destroyed, which the more idiotic in the sort of political world aspired to do, there would not be a partner to work with. There could not be a centrist South African government, and the unitary state couldn't survive, and we'd fragment into some sort of balkanized enclave society. And many in the middle class might do very well there, but the unitary state wouldn't survive. So this GNU is a solid thing, and it's not a sort of happenstance. You're at an investment conference, and I've on Alex's show and elsewhere said a lot that this is the best thing that could have happened to the country. Very rare that happens in any society. I say to my sort of American friends, and I've great regard for America and ties there, that imagine a society where the loser conceded defeat in the election, and then no one stormed the Union Building. And afterwards, a bipartisan deal was struck, by which point they would tell you it's an absurd suggestion that the two could come together to form a government. We did that here, and we should be very grateful for it. So let's go beyond that. Start to look at the flags that risk this thing. There are dissidents around who are not in favor of this deal for various reasons. And they will seek to wreck the deal. Probably into early 2027, we will see the first major stress test, a local government election, followed by the ANC's efforts to pick a new leader. There is no guarantee that the GNU, there's no guarantee, not that it won't survive. There's no guarantee that the GNU survives the contestation. They're all going to go to campaign against each other, all the partners. Then the ANC needs to pick a new leader on the back of that. That's the first major, could collect two bumps, but one big bump in the road that this GNU needs to get over. So we can be very pleased with what's happened, and we deserve that, but now we look a bit ahead. Whether we survive, the GNU survives those bumps, will probably hinge on two things. First is radicalization, and the second is the efforts of that gentleman over there and Eskom. And I'll tell you why. We are a completely unradicalized society in terms of public opinion. Despite the history, despite the present state of inequalities, a decade of effectively falling real per capita GDP, the social fabric of society is extremely strong, contrary to what you know, I don't make this up. This is, we do the work. Contrary to what you read in the media. However, only 6 in 100 kids who sit in grade one will pass maths and matric with a grade of 50% or higher. And that's in an economy where the structure of GDP has really, since the late 1960s, evolved away from primary and secondary industries, mining, farming, manufacturing, stuff you dig out of the ground or make, into the high-tech, high-skilled tertiary world. On the back of that, our national unemployment rate is now 33%. The global rate this year is just over 5%. The Economist years ago ran a famous front page in which it made the stunning point that unemployment was really not a political problem in a lot of the world because it's been solved. It doesn't really exist. And yet we sit with these extreme inequalities. The growth outlook inside the GNU, if it holds together, because it won't be particularly bold on reform in education, or in the labor market elsewhere, is perhaps 2%. South Africa has, as a rule of thumb, for 30 years generated 100,000 net new jobs per point of GDP growth per year, and that rule shouldn't necessarily have held, but it has. When Mr. Mandela and Mr. Mbeki ran South Africa, the country generated 500,000 net new jobs a year, the consequence of which is that by the time Mr. Mbeki packed up his office, twice as many people were in employment as had been the case when the ANC came to power, despite the jobless growth story that you continue to read in the mainstream media today, which is a warning. Be very careful of what you consume in the media. At 2% growth, we cannot reduce the unemployment rate. We can hold it where it is. And if you're the chaps at MK who are so very, very sharp and well strategically, but I sometimes say to people, if I had to go to war politically, I'd take two people, maybe three people with me. I'd take Helen Ziller and Jacob Zuma and Gayton McKenzie. I'll add him to the list, and we'll win the election and have a very sort of successful society. Maybe, you never know. If you're those guys, and I mean the MK and EFF guys, you're a bit sore, you're frozen out, you're on those opposition benches, but you're brilliant revolutionary strategists, something Westerners don't understand anything of, which is why the West is losing around. You know that in that 6% maths pass rate and that unemployment rate and that growth rate is your way back into power. So this GNU is not secured yet. We have evaded catastrophe, but we're not in the clear. We will measure the extent of radicalization in our society. And if the radicalization markers tick up, that will be a flag for you to watch on whether this GNU is able to hold or not, because we could do the deal because public opinion was sensible and moderate in the main. The failure of the revolutionary strategists, and that they'll admit this. I mean, if they were here, it would be fascinating. They'd say you're completely right, is that far too little of an effort was made to radicalize public opinion in the face of the ANC's inevitable defeat in order to allow the radical left to seize power. And they won't make that mistake again. The second issue on which South Africa's, the GNU, will hinge is the question of energy. And it's very nice to be here with Alec, because it was here and on his YouTube channels that 2 years back we first said load shedding would come to an end at a time when the rest were talking about stage eight and whatever. And the reason we said it is because of exactly the strategies that Eskom and the extremely shrewd ANC, thank God that there's an ANC energy minister, because if the DA was in charge, we'd be copying the New York Times editorial page and sending our country hurtling towards recession and social disorder, because we wouldn't have the energy. We wouldn't have the coal energy necessary to support in the longer term an industrial recovery. However, the enormous successes that the Eskom people with the energy minister have achieved, they don't get nearly the credit. It's like Mbeki and the job creation and service delivery in the first decade. It's sort of ignored, but it's well, what's happened on the energy availability factor, I'm sure we'll hear about later, is a remarkable achievement of government. Faces a threat, and the threat comes from the Europeans and the Americans, whose Africa strategy is premised on decarbonization and turning off South Africa's coal-fired power and putting caps on emissions. If we want our unemployment rate of 33% to one day be 5%, we will have to double or triple the country's carbon emissions. So European strategy towards the GNU on energy must have the inevitable consequence of sabotaging the GNU. And that is one of the key. We don't face this problem from Russia and China, whose energy advice towards South Africa is far more sensible than anything we're getting from the Europeans or Americans. And I've had this conversation with various diplomats and policymakers abroad, and they shrug their shoulders, as one person did, of some influence, and sort of said, well, you're probably right, but this is our policy and this is what we're going to pursue. So we'll need to defeat the radicalization risk, and we'll need to defeat Western Africa policy, which is premised on decarbonization, in order for the GNU to survive. If we defeat those two adversaries, then the prospects are serious that through the late 2020s and into the 2030s, South Africa can again reach the average growth rates of emerging markets, which is what we did in our first decade as a democracy when we doubled the number of people with jobs and achieved numerous other extraordinary successes. We built in that decade 10 formal houses for every one shack that was newly erected, despite Mbeki being accused in the media of service delivery failures, which was just wrong on the facts of it. So watch these two issues and how we navigate our way through them. Beat them, and the outlook, certainly into the 2030s, is that South Africa could easily be positioned as one of the world's most competitive emerging markets. And I've got a minute, so I just want to say another Eskom point. Our assessment in the firm that I run is that if the current track that the energy minister has put South Africa on, if he's allowed to hold that line, there is enough defunct coal capacity in the country and surplus grid capacity for the idea that there is an energy-imposed ceiling, an infrastructure, energy infrastructure ceiling on the country's growth rate to fall away. And we can take the energy ceiling out of the equation in starting to estimate what future rates of growth in the country could be. And Alec, thank you very much.
Thank you, Franz. It's always a privilege to get a rational perspective of what's going on in our country, and particularly at this very important time. But there are people who are in the audience, I'm sure, thinking and about, you know, what's he saying about Russia and China actually have got South Africa right and the West hasn't, particularly with decarbonization? And that moves to the next point. Can you just give us your views on BRICS and the South African involvement there and where we should be going on it?
So, I mean, the South Africa is a minor part.
Sorry, Kate.
Would agree.
Okay. Well, good.
How's that? Great. I mean, it's South Africa becomes a democracy in what is essentially a unipolar world. The Soviets have been defeated. In the West, the view takes hold that it's the end of history, that the last serious challenge to the liberal democratic order is done, and that there will not be another challenge again. And any Western national security or strategic thinker who's now in their late 40s, early 50s, so they're becoming senior, grew up in a world where they believed that the key ideological and security threats had abated. And because they grew up in that world, they lost the ability to think in terms of deterrence and the use of hard power. But their adversaries in Iran, China, Russia didn't fall for the end of history delusion and realize that it hadn't happened. As a consequence, the West is on the downslope globally, and influence of Western adversaries is rising. The implication for South Africa as an emerging market is we're no longer in a unipolar world. We're now in a multipolar world. And as a, we're sub 1% fraction of global GDP, a South African foreign policy, and this applies universally, cannot be to pick sides in these global conflicts. It needs to be to pursue a national interest foreign policy. We could learn a great deal from India and India's foreign policy. And it's a criticism I have of DA foreign policy going into GNU. It's completely naive to think that it's sustainable for an emerging market like South Africa to take a hostile approach to Russia. The DA has been in China recently, and they very quickly embraced the one China policy and were vastly impressed by what they encountered. But it's completely naive to think you can take a hostile A New York Times editorial page approach to Russia, just as it's entirely counterproductive, and it has been, although this is now being repaired, for some of the hotheads in the ANC to think that you can take a that's constructive to take a hostile approach to the Western world. So that when you think about BRICS and SA, BRICS in itself more or less important, you can argue, but the important point is it's no longer a unipolar world. We're a sub 1% of global GDP economy in a multipolar world, and our foreign policy needs to reflect that. You also need this thing of seeing the world through the false and true paradigm, or the consensus paradigm, is so important as well. Is what I said on energy. What Western diplomats are doing here on energy is criminal, and is a major risk to the survival and stability of South Africa as a democracy. But people go along with it because that's the consensus. We must decarbonize. We must decarbonize. Whatever your view on climate is, our contribution, very minor. Whereas as Russian and Chinese advice to the South African government is correct on what the country needs to do from an energy perspective if it is to be a successful and competitive emerging market. But you'll be hard-pressed to find that point made in the media or in business, because it's simply too far at odds with the consensus to be said as often as it needs to be said. Alec?
The hypocrisy is breathtaking in certain instances, isn't it? You mentioned Gayton McKenzie, who's been a regular participant at BizNews conferences. You didn't mention Herman Mashaba, who seems to be a little bit of a loose cannon right now. Could you give us your views on what's happening in China in particular, and whether this could be something that is a epitaph for the Action SA, or indeed something that's going to make them stronger?
Look, I mean, you know, I don't like the sort of getting into the surrounded by your walls of new cameras, soap operas of politics. So I'll say this. Action SA had an enormous opportunity to position itself on the urban fringe, where it would have been very competitive inside formerly dominant ANC constituencies. And the resources of the party of ASA, however, were directed at other objectives, competing in the Western Cape with the DA, unsettling DA-led government. And I think you see the consequences in its data and its poll numbers, which are a fraction of what it might have been had the leadership of the party been able to get over themselves and focus on the strategic objective and the market that was wide open for them to capture, which they won't capture again now, because if we'll see a bit of new life in the economy. We've had this immense success on electricity. The ANC will begin, if it sticks it out in the GNU, will begin to close the doors that were open to opposition parties to challenge it on the urban periphery. So I'm afraid what may have happened is ASA's opportunity is lost, and it will fade into being a small party, and then in the fullness of time, you know, these parties become so small later that you have to kind of ask your intern whether they still exist or not before you talk to someone. And I'm afraid that's where it's headed to, and it was entirely unnecessary.
But you would take Gayton McKenzie to war with you. So his small party seems to have a different trajectory.
Oh, but he's very good. In terms of strategy and understanding, he's exceptional. Now, people make the mistake of saying, well, they don't know if they like him. Or if you grew up in white suburbia, you know, the chap went to prison. You don't kind of know how to relate to that. And so these issues become prejudice towards the chap. His background and understanding of the country and of, we spoke about the use of hard power, which Westerners have lost the ability to do completely because they still believe in the end of history. He's got all of these advantages. There were some politicians, well, when the negotiations were happening for the GNU and the sort of people who were discussing ministries, there was a view around that the sports ministry is kind of a stupid ministry. So you don't want to, you send a sort of moron to the sports ministry. You can't do anything with it. You know, you need a serious ministry like, well, no, trade and industry, and then you can, you know. He has been magnificent in what he's done with the sports ministry in building a political platform for himself and inspiring South Africans around. And I've said it very often on him, and I've said it to him as well. Yeah, he's one of the few politicians, for all the prejudice about his background, he's one of the few politicians that I would think of sending a book recommendation to, because he will be grateful for it and he will read it, because he didn't have that opportunity growing up. He had a different experience to many of us. So my advice on him has always been, take him very, very seriously, because he has strategic advantages and insights and ability and intelligence that is in excess of that of almost any other opposition politician in the country. And he is, as far as I can see, he loves what he's doing. Every day, it's great to get up and do it again. So my comment on him is, take him very seriously into the future. Maybe he'll make mistakes. Maybe he'll self-destruct. Maybe all manner of things can happen. Short of that, I think he's a very important figure.
Government of National Unity going into the future. You gave us an uplifting story, but the foreign investors kind of buy it, but haven't quite. The local companies haven't been opening the taps. We hear, I think you might have quoted it, 1.5 trillion rand in cash on South African corporate balance sheets. When are they going to get it that this could be a opportunity for them to start investing? And once they start, perhaps the foreigners will follow.
I'll tell you how that I see the conversation going with some of them, and what they say and why. But first, a comment on relativism. Watch this. This is always going to happen on the GNU. As we got months and months past the GNU, people will begin to become frustrated with it. And they'll forget how very, very well we did as a country to achieve that result. And they'll start to say, well, it's disappointing. It hasn't secured the growth. So the relativism will be there. Despite the enormous successes and the genius of Eskom and the energy minister, which is what it is, the other constraints on growth, national health insurance is an existential threat because you cannot have a middle class in a society that doesn't provide world-class healthcare services. Labour market policy that prices people who are poorly educated out of the labour market, just as 2 points, are sufficient to hold back, are sufficient to make South Africa from a sort of capital investment destination not competitive enough to beat the alternatives around the world yet. In the room, if you sit in an investment bank in London and talk about South Africa, they say, firstly, they're very surprised that you guys pulled this off, or American diplomats or whatever they are, very surprised. They didn't see it coming. They thought you on the way to catastrophe. It's good. Definitely worth a sniff, bit of a punt. You've seen that in the 10-year yield in SA. You've seen the results. So there is a result. But then they will say to me, what is your growth forecast? And I'll say, "We the GNU's first obstacle is get to 2%. And as long as that remains the answer, we're not going to open the country to the capital flows that are necessary to take the GNU from, let's say, stage one success, which has been immensely good, to a point where South Africa is again one of the world's most competitive emerging markets.
On an international front, how are you reading what's going on in Europe? You said that they seem to have lost their way to a degree.
Look, I think if you turn off the most efficient sources of the Western world broadly, if you get into a position where you convince that at a significant level that the best thing to do is to turn off the most efficient sources of energy that are available to your economy, and at the same time to flood economies with vast sums of money, that you have an inflationary effect that stunts your progress. At the same time, the Western world is taken up with a political ideology that it is inherently illegitimate, in that Western power was built on exploitation, and that moral virtue in the West is to align with the apparently prejudiced or downtrodden against relative elites. If you add the energy ideology to the money printing at times, now it's slowing, and the protectionism, to the idea that it is illegitimate to project Western power as morally illegitimate given history of colonial rule, it's very difficult to see how Western democracies can remain, can be not a dominant force, it's certainly a very influential force. But they will certainly be given a run for their money by a China, a Russia, and the like, who do not suffer the same ideological quandaries about whether you turn off your power station, greatly raise the cost of doing business, whether you force wholly unrealistic electrical vehicle requirements onto your country, whether you should appoint people on merit or on other grounds to keep position. So the West must become relatively less competitive over time as it becomes less willing to project what power it has into the rest of the world. So the West is on and Western societies are so deeply divided as well. And all of which comes back to here, where we are. And I don't think we necessarily give ourselves the credit we're due. The values that South Africans think are important, which were traditional Western values once, now under assault in the West, are much more deeply held here than in many Western democracies. Social cohesion inside of, I've made this point three times already, here is much stronger than somewhere like America, the ability to do these bipartisan political deals. On energy, we have a government on the ANC side of it, not on the DA, but on the ANC side of it, that understands what's needed to do on energy. The geostrategic, no one understands, the geostrategic location of South Africa on the South Atlantic. The South Atlantic's going to become a piece of real estate as important as the South China Sea. Because if you can sail a submarine from Lobito and Angola, or Bata and Equatorial Guinea, you're closer to New York than if that submarine had a base in Hawaii. Mrs. Thatcher sent a battle group to the Falklands not because of national pride. The key opening exchanges of the First and Second World Wars were in the South Atlantic that opened the North Atlantic. If something happens to Suez or Panama, all global bulk shipping moves between the 50th and 60th parallels around the coast of South America or South Africa. The assets we possess, the values in the country, which are necessary to be competitive, to West is lost, is losing. The social cohesion, which we possess in far greater measure than they do, the common sense on something like energy, the strategic locations. If you add this stuff together, you really have to hold yourself back from beginning to think that play these cards right as South Africa, have a sensible foreign policy that reaches out across the globe, doesn't try and pick sides in these absurd conflicts between the Europeans and Americans and their global rivals. If you play these cards correctly as a country, you can actually, if you start doing the math on it, South Africa can become, through the 2030s, a truly influential global and a very successful global economy.
It's really exciting, isn't it, listening to Frans?
Thanks, Alan.
Whoa, 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 whoa. This is part three. On to part three, and I did stop a little early on my questions because we have got many here. Kostavet wants to know, does the ANC have alternative untainted leaders to Paul Mashatile after Ramaphosa?
Look, I mean, in the political world, you want to go and find untainted leaders, and then you want to start. It's very difficult to do that anywhere. I mean, Mr. Trump in America, who might be a very positive influence on South Africa's evolution, has been running around with hookers and porn stars. So I think it's part of this Western end of history idea that to be successful, because there were no, the West started to believe there were no great existential threats, you could just be nice and you could find nice people. The right, who are the great reformers of the post-Second World War era? It's Park, it's Lee Kuan Yew, it's Deng in China. These weren't nice liberal Democrats who you would. These were hard guys who made shrewd and pragmatic decisions. If South Africa is to be successful, it would be very nice if whoever did that was a sort of nice liberal Democrat who studied sociology at UCT. But the likelihood is that's not what you're going to have. And what you've got to look for is a hard, tough, ruthless individual with a streak of brilliance who is able to force unpopular decisions in the face of the kinds of pressures. You see, the trouble is if you get a nice kind of sociology graduate, they're just going to fold in the face of European pressure on energy in SA, and then the GNU fails. So the question on I don't know who the next, I've got no idea who the next ANC leader is going to be, but I hope it is a person that ticks the boxes of the ruthlessness. Mr. Ramaphosa hasn't had that. Mr. Mandela had that. He was extremely ruthless in the decisions he made, and brilliant, and set up the successes. I mean, the whole Father Christmas thing was a Hollywood creation. I mean, in practice, that wasn't what he was at all. But Mr. Ramaphosa doesn't have the ruthless streak, and hence he has led his party. I mean, if you're an ANC guy, 40% after 100-plus years, that is catastrophic. So look for ruthless brilliance, which is sufficient to, again, see the world through the true-false paradigm and not the comfortable
We've got lots of questions, so we'll try and get through as many as we can, but I do know that France will answer them if we can't get to them here. Rob Hersoff wants to know, how's Gaetan McKenzie doing as a minister, and why does the DA not embrace him?
Well, I've told you how Gaetan's doing, and he does it because he's got many of the attributes that I've just listed. And the DA doesn't embrace him because it regards him as a rival, which he is in some respects. And I don't want to get into a DA strategic discussion, but if you were a party like the DA, there are perhaps two ways you can think about strategy. One is, do you want to grow by pulling in new constituencies beyond your established multi-generational middle class? And by the way, in this election, less than half of DA voters were white, because the established multi-generational middle class isn't white. Do you want to grow beyond that constituency if you're the DA? It's very dangerous if you try that, because into your party you'll bring competing constituencies, and that will cause internal conflict. It's much safer, would be my advice, to hold your constituency, your 20%, maybe you can make it 25 if the economy grows quickly, one day 30, and bring in as partners people who command alternative constituencies that are different to yours. Because in coalition, you can bring competing constituencies together and they won't fight with each other. But inside one organization, if you bring two ideological views or too broader, so that's the same. It's the same Western idea that comes from the end of history, that you can bring everyone together into one organization. They'll all find some common ground. It's very difficult to run multicultural societies, and South Africa runs well because it's in fact not a very multicultural society, because the values, culture is essentially a question of values. The values that are common to South Africans are pretty much universal. Across lines of history and race and class and socioeconomic status. So the embrace of McKenzie or anyone would depend on the strategy you pursue. And the strategy to consider is, hold your constituency, take it into negotiations with everyone else, and be comfortable with the fact that they're going to command a particular constituency that you're going to be hands-off of.
There's so many good questions here. Eden Gagiano wants to know, with 38% of agricultural exports going to Africa and 28% going to Asia, so that's two-thirds combined, does it make much sense to jump through EU and others' protectionist hoops?
Yeah, no, I mean, the same advice. I don't know the agricultural export data, but what I do know is it would be a lot better if we didn't have foot and mouth disease and if horse sickness vaccines were widely available, so you don't apparently have to export your horse to Mauritius.
No, that's all changed. Just changed. Just changed. They're happy about that.
If you could overall get exports up. But the answer to all those questions is the multilateral foreign policy that you pursue. And it's not a question of picking. The ANC makes that mistake, or had, particularly under its previous foreign minister, try to pick favourites. And the DA makes that mistake in its line on some of the West's adversaries. and it's best abandoned and a plain national interest foreign policy pursuit.
Gavin Rome wants to know, is water scarcity and quality the same flag now as collapse of energy and electricity was 10 years ago?
I imagine that it must be at a certain extent, but again, and we'll, these things are not, I mean, water infrastructure apparently is more difficult to fix than energy infrastructure, because it's pipes and sits underground. But it's absurd to get into a position where you run out of electricity as a country. It's not easy to fix, but it's perfectly fixable. And we've demonstrated that. And you can do that with shrewd strategy and professional management. I mean, the Romans had water. We do not need to have a water problem. Apply the correct strategy and efficient management. Water problem is immediately resolved.
Jabu Ntlube wants to know, is there any chance of Gayton McKenzie joining the DA or ANC to enhance his prospects for the next election cycle?
I don't know. I don't ever see how it would enhance his prospects. I think he's perhaps better off on... I don't know what he'd want to do or not do. But I think he is... if you're higher caliber, not that everyone else, but that many of your rivals... You're not going to get anywhere by joining up with the rivals that you're starting to make inroads into. So I think he can do, and in the Western Cape, you know, Western Cape demographics, this stuff's real, splits, I think, 50-30-20, the racial demographics. And the 50 is coloured and the 30 is black. And the 20 is white. So it's unrealistic to believe that coloured nationalist politics will not eventually command the balance of power in the Western Cape. And the DA cannot be a coloured nationalist party because that would contradict its core constituency. So, you know, I mean, Mr. McKenzie asked where he might end up. This is an avenue. And if you command the balance of power in the Western Cape, you have leverage over the national government at a vast level. And I don't know what his strategy is, but if he were to sit in front of me and say, do I think this would work, I would say to him, I'm certain maybe you're onto something here. You become very, very powerful as a consequence.
Andrew Hume wants to know, does MK die post-Zuma? And if so, where does that vote go to, the IFP or the ANC?
You know, Zuma's an exceptional guy as well. And again, it mustn't be misconstrued as was I in favor of state capture? But on the facts of it, he was a masterful strategist. He'd been that from his early days when he was trained by the former Eastern Bloc, including in the Ukraine, of all places. And he was highly regarded. When the liberal media, when he was locked up for a weekend or whatever it was, the liberal media rejoiced that we're beating state capture. Zuma doesn't give a damn if he's sleeping on a concrete floor of a prison cell back in Nkandla. And it motivated a response. And he is a brilliant guy, a tactician and strategist. And so he got, with some help, got his party up to 10 plus. We read into that vote through in the run-up to the election. I think what the data showed is the chief motivation for voting for Zuma was the perception of his persecution, not his policies. His manifesto. His readers didn't know what was in his manifesto. But he positioned himself as the persecutor. And that resonated with key ANC constituencies that felt their party had become distant and aloof. It had retreated into the sort of glistening towers of Gauteng and forgotten about them. And that motivated the the votes. I've even told some clients, don't necessarily think the Zuma vote was a radical vote. It was a nationalist vote. Nationalism's real, and it can't be wished away. But it was motivated by the perception of his persecution. The challenge for the people who are joining up now will be to try and provide a new motive to vote for MK. And I don't know if they can succeed, because public opinion remains so moderate that the radical populist message here doesn't work politically. The EFF's also run by a brilliant chap who's very determined and hardworking and committed. And the Red Beret deserves a marketing award. I mean, it's a genius state that if you have that on, you belong as a youngster for the first time to something. You're a kid who never had a good education. You're never going to get a job. But when you put on that beret, you have esteem. For the first time, you're esteemed. And the EFF message is perfectly plain. You're not under any illusions as to what they have in mind. But they can't break 10% of the vote in a country where more than half of young black people don't have a job. And the reason goes back to what I said about radicalization. The society is not radicalized. And I think it's unlikely that MK's young lieutenants, who are flooding there in numbers to take over from Zuma's success, will easily be able to give that voter after Zuma dies, which he will one day, after he's gone, to give them a new reason to vote for MK. That's going to be very hard for them to do.
Pete Lowe says, can you please comment on the distrust between business and government, GNU included, in terms of allocating capital from their balance sheets into growing their businesses?
I don't think it's trust. I think it's again this... It's again this Western obsession with if we were nice and could find each other and this end of history we could get on, we'll get along to go, we'll find consensus. And a perhaps more effective strategy will be to learn the use of hard power, to bring hard power forward and force consequences. If you studied proper revolutionary theory and ideology, which top ANC people will be well schooled in, you would immediately warm to what I'm about to say, which is Lenin's injunction that when you probe with a bayonet and you meet steel, it goes clunk, you stop. If you meet mush, you proceed. That's the antithesis of the Western world's approach to problems after the end of history. You just must be nice and indulge. We'll find common ground with each other. If, broadly speaking, and it doesn't mean it's a hostile exchange, but if the business community here wishes to have a more productive relationship with the government, it should learn from that example. It's definitely not hostility. It's the ability to force a balance of power and to demonstrate consequences, and not as prominent attorney who spent a lot of time in one of South Africa's industries said, is the industry, I don't name because you'll know who the person was, but the industry has faded. And one of his remarks on why it faded is he said, my clients went along with the government to get along with the government. And in the end, the industry is a fraction of what it might have been had they taken a firmer approach. And it's certainly been my experience of the ANC on a number of issues that if you want a good relationship with it, and these are tough guys. They come from a very difficult past. I mean, if you were a young ANC activist facing the horrors of the security police or General Hendrik van der Berg, you're not going to be offended by some CEO saying something mildly critical of your policy on telecommunication. You know, you don't have to worry about that. If you want a good relationship with the ANC and government, you need to demonstrate the ability to draw a line of the sand and force deterrence and a balance of power. And it's nerve-wracking to South African business leaders, because our transition coincided with the broader end of history, fell for the same delusion as many in the West, that if you're nice and accommodative, you'll get your way. You need to take force balances of power, and what you'll find, to your astonishment, is that very often your relationship with ANC people in government begins to improve because you're now speaking a language that's universally understood.
Fascinating. I'm going to close off with this because we have tea waiting. David Melville wants to know, what can we as individuals or teams do to address or improve unemployment? And I love your bayonet analogy. Maybe there's a way to bring that into this conversation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for many of us who are still here in the country, I mean, that I think is the first step. And I don't begrudge people who exited. It's ultimately the fault of South African policymakers who couldn't position South Africa as a competitive and desirable destination. So I don't buy this patriotic sense that if you left, you somehow betrayed those that remained. But an advantage of being in a country where a lot of very competitive people and top minds have left is that the opportunity is also very great. The competition is reduced. South Africa's cheap. You can buy into South Africa very, very cheaply at the moment. To start, I mean, there are so many, if you have a good idea here, you're likely one of very few people who've had that idea. If you have that same idea in North America, you can be damn sure there are a whole lot of MIT graduates who've had it already, and they've pursued it, and most of them have failed, and the ones that have succeeded have frozen you out. So I think that for those who remain, and that the competition around us has removed itself very often, and given the immense upsides, if we learn to exploit our varied strategic advantages that I've set out already, being here, committing and investing to the in the country has upsides that if you do a realistic assessment, weighing it up, will you actually be better off trying to pursue the same effort and energy in any other global investment destination at the moment as what is the case here? But to be here, you need to be able to embrace, I think, a bit of a frontier lifestyle. It's not going to be the most stable place on earth. There'll be very sort of thrilling moments. And I think you must enjoy that. It must be the active choice to be here because on an objective basis, it offers you opportunities and a kind of life that you won't have anywhere else in the world. T. Lawrence said, to be happy, you need two things, an adventure and a cause worthy of devotion. And I think here we have both of those in abundance. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Frans. I see that you've started reading the Howard Marks book that I gave you. The key point in that whole book is second-level thinking, and I think we've been given a masterclass in that today. Thanks again.